Language is impossibly complicated, and yet nearly every one of us uses it with ease. In this episode, we look for clues to answer questions about the origin of language in the story of the world's newest language, how it arose, and what it tells us about what it means to be human. I'm Ben Lord. You're listening to I Heart This. In 1979, Nicaragua was one of the poorest nations in the Western Hemisphere, and the people of Nicaragua were some of the least educated. Children in first grade in Nicaraguan schools had about a 1 in 5 chance of getting to the 6th grade. 3/4 of the population was illiterate. The new Sandinistan government, anxious to show that it could improve the lives of the Nicaraguan people, set out to reform the country's education system in a national literacy crusade. And as part of that reform, they established a special education center in the capital city of Managua. And as part of that center, it founded several schools for deaf children, the first serious, large-scale attempt to do so in the country's history. At the time, deafness in Nicaragua was widely misunderstood. Rather than diagnosing deafness as a condition related to hearing, most Nicaraguans, it seemed, focused on the deaf's inability to speak. And deafness was often wrongly correlated with cognitive impairment. The birth of a deaf child was widely viewed as a punishment from God, divine retribution for a family's sins. And even if they were treated with loving care by their families, deaf children had no way to communicate with the people around them. There was no sign language in Nicaragua, except for whatever gestures might be used between a deaf person and their family. The deaf most often lived lives of isolation, stigmatized, incurable, and entirely dependent. When the new government established the first schools for the deaf, they were investing in some of the most marginalized people in one of the most marginalized countries in the world. The goal of this schooling was the cultivation of productive members of Nicaragua's workforce. So these schools provided vocational training, which was fairly successful, and language training, which wasn't. Under the leadership of a Russian consultant, Natalia Popova, no relation to the celebrated figure skater, these schools embraced a philosophy of oralism. Instead of teaching a sign language, which would only allow students to communicate with each other, the school committed instead to teaching students to use Spanish, both by speaking and by reading lips, so that they could communicate with society at large. Other than rudimentary fingerspelling, gesture was discouraged in class. This spoken language training was a dismal failure, with vanishingly few students coming to any facility in Spanish. But even if it had succeeded, it is doubtful that the larger goal of assimilation would have followed. As the mother of one of the deaf students related, she once heard her daughter speaking in the other room and went to investigate, only to find her daughter talking to herself in the mirror. When the mother asked what she was doing, the daughter replied that this was all she could do to practice, with her thickly accented Spanish. No one else would speak to her. One would be forgiven for thinking that these schools were an utter waste. Whatever job skills they might have gained, students were as linguistically isolated from Nicaraguan culture as they had ever been. Often, not even their teachers could speak to or understand them. And yet, totally unintentionally, these schools created something that would not only empower their students, but also change the way the entire world understood language. In the summer of 1986, an American linguist named Judy Kegel got a call from the Nicaraguan Ministry of Education. Something strange was happening at the schools of the deaf, something that the ministry and the teachers at the school didn't understand, and they needed help figuring out what to do. Judy agreed to come to the schools of the deaf in Managua, and what she observed in the schoolyards there would astound everyone. All around her, kids were communicating by sign. This is not something they'd learned in the classrooms, not anything that they'd learned at home. When these schools had started, not even a decade ago, there had been no sign language of any kind in all of Nicaragua. And although it was composed of signs that Judy had never seen before, it didn't take long for her to understand that the gestures and signs that the students were using weren't just some amalgam of disparate signals. These kids, behind the backs of their teachers, had invented a new language, seemingly from thin air. To truly appreciate the awesomeness of this, take a moment to ponder just how fantastically complicated language is. This isn't as easy as you might think, because to someone who has used language as long as they can remember, its complexity often becomes invisible. Linguists typically divide the study of language into several components, each of which is dizzying on its own. First are the basic building blocks, the sounds or gestures that make up a language. In English, for example, some sounds like p and b and m are part of our language, and other ones like or are not. The allowable sounds or gestures are different in each language. In English, we don't use the sound r, but French does. Sign languages use several kinds of clicks. When we learn a language, we have to learn which sounds are language sounds and which ones are not. But sounds don't actually occur in discrete units like that. So we don't actually learn to recognize individual sounds so much as we learn the range of those sounds that count as a particular unit or phoneme. Sometimes those ranges can be quite wide. In Hawaiian, the w sound and v sounds are interchangeable. In others, they're quite narrow. A novice in French, like me, might ask the waiter for vin, hoping to get some wine, when I've actually, and confusingly for the waiter, asked for wind. The difference between vin and vin might take some practice, but sometimes the sound differentiations made so easily by native speakers seem nearly impossible to non-native ones. It is easy for a native English speaker to hear and produce the differences between ol and er. But if your first language is Japanese, which only has a similar sound right in the middle between ol and er, it takes a great deal of practice to learn to separate them. And then, even when you do, you need to remember which one to use in every single word. This reveals the trouble with not just learning to distinguish the sound you hear, but also to move your mouth and tongue and lips in just the right way to recreate them. And that is just the first layer of complexity. Next, you have to learn how to arrange whatever sounds are in your toolkit into workable syllables and words. In any given language, not all sounds can go together. Think of a word spelled LPDA, which can't be pronounced in English. It's a non-word. Then compare that to DALP, DALP, which can be pronounced just fine. DALP isn't a non-word, it's just a nonsense word. In language, a small number of possible sounds can become a staggering number of pronounceable syllables. No language in the world has just 10 consonants and 10 vowels. All of them have more. But even a language with such a tiny number of sounds that limited itself to only arranging them in a consonant-vowel-consonant pattern in each syllable, even that simplest language would have a trillion possible four-syllable words. Only a tiny fraction of possible words are ever used as true words, allowing for a nearly limitless store of new words to be coined. The words blog and COVID and podcast, for example, were meaningless nonsense words when I was a kid, but now they're words that people use all the time. And that's just the second layer. Beyond that is where it starts to get really hard. People who study language learning estimate that a novice in a language typically needs about 3,000 words and their variations just to get by. This is the biggest obstacle to learning a language beyond your native one. It's just the raw scale. But 3,000 is just the tip of an iceberg. Most native speakers have command of about 20,000 word families. and a college education can easily double that number. Most school-age children learn an average of 10 new words a day. A day! And learning a word isn't just about learning a combination of sounds. We have to build what each individual word means. When I say dog, and you picture something in your mind, it might be completely different than the dog I see in mine. Dog is a wide-ranging idea that can encompass a poodle and a Great Dane and a Chihuahua. What a miracle that you and I can use that word and understand each other. What miracle more that you and I can see a breed that we've never seen before and both instantly recognize it as a dog. And yet, if someone says, "It's been a long day, I gotta go rest my dogs," you know they're not talking about Chihuahuas. And you know that if I use the word dog to talk about another person, it would be terribly offensive, even when we talk about our pet dogs with the utmost affection. Each word is its own little universe of meaning. But even then, words alone do not a language make. I could say, "The dog chased the cat," and you would know what I meant. But if I said, "The chased cat dog the," it would mean nothing. Words only have meaning in certain orders and structures, and each language has its own rules, and they are all extremely complicated. This is the layer of syntax and grammar, and while we spend time trying to articulate the rules of grammar in school, we don't actually learn syntax and grammar there, at least not in our native languages. Instead, in school, we just learn to recognize and understand and write the patterns that we already know. It delights and amazes me how we learn these rules, and yet they remain invisible to us. We learn them without ever learning them. Why is "Akbar bathed himself" meaningful when "himself bathed Akbar" isn't? Why does "a big red balloon" sound fine to me when "a red big balloon" sounds weird? But we're still not done. Even meaningful words in a grammatical order can be meaningless. Colorless green ideas sleep furiously. On their own, each one of those words means something, just not together in that way. And then there's the context. If Judy walks into John's apartment and says, "I'm leaving," and John answers, "Who is he?" in most situations, this would make no sense at all. What does "who is he" have to do with "I'm leaving"? But if you're like me, your brain automatically fills in the context with a story about how John and Judy are romantically involved, and Judy has found another lover. "I'm leaving. Who is he?" And we haven't even scratched the surface of intonation and idiom and innuendo or reading and writing. We cannot even begin to wrap our heads around it all, and yet we do all of this in an instant. Language is like breathing right on the boundary between conscious and unconscious worlds. Just as I can intentionally take a deep breath, I can also choose my words carefully. And yet most of the time I don't. I hardly ever think about which words will come next or which order I will put them in any more than I usually think about breathing. This miraculous superpower of language is so improbable that understanding its evolution and origins has been called the hardest problem in science. How can something so impossible to understand be so easy to do? How could school children invent something like that out of thin air? When Judy Kegel saw the kids signing in the schoolyard, they were using verb tenses and agreement and pronoun references in first, second, and third person. This new Nicaraguan sign language was unlike American sign language or any other. In all the world, there was nothing quite like it. And in 1980, it didn't exist. But then in 1986, it did. In 2025, people estimate that there are more than 1,500 speakers of Nicaraguan Sign Language. What happened? How did it start? It's likely we will never know the full story. But we do know this. When the government had created these schools, they inadvertently created a community. They had brought together a group of people with hopes and loves and traumas and desires. They had brought people with something to say, together with people to say it to. And so they did. While these children were discouraged from signing in school itself, they were with each other at meals and at recess and on the buses. The idiosyncratic gestures they had used with their families were probably the starting point. That and a desire to connect, to have someone else in the world know what you think and what you feel. None of us are born knowing Korean or Swahili. I mean, language isn't instinctual, like laughter or tears. But clearly, something in our brains is primed for it. And just as clearly, it is not something that we can unlock on our own. Like the deaf children brought out of isolation and into community in the Nicaraguan schools, language only arises when we have someone to share it with. And I think this is true not just for language. We contain within ourselves the seeds of beautiful things, seeds that only grow in the supportive presence of others. In order to realize our talents, indeed in order to become ourselves, we need other people to do it. We evolved to be together. There is no spontaneous language. There is no self-made man. We all make each other together. Hey everyone, I'm looking down the road at what's coming up next for iHeartThis, and I would really like to hear from you. What would you like to hear more of? Should we do more interviews, more on the street episodes? Do you know of inspiring or insightful stories that we should tell or people that we should talk to? How would you feel about guest essayists or hearing other voices on the show? Tell me what you'd like to listen to. Email me at ben@iheartthispodcast.com or leave a message on the iHeartThis podcast Facebook page. And thanks to everyone who has been spreading the word. iHeartThis has doubled its listenership since the beginning of 2025, and that is entirely thanks to people like you sharing our work with other people. I am so honored to have your recommendation. iHeartThis is written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo was designed by Brian Imaro Cribbs. Our website is iHeartThisPodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, be kind, be curious, and be thankful.